put 50,000 change money in this spot, right?
It was 300 Quaker, probably in the spot, up in Chizu.
They steal the door, they turn the cage.
Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Just riding the light.
What can I be, Carl? What the hell can be done? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome back to another episode of Gangland Wire Crime Stories. I'm here in the beautiful studios in Midtown Kansas City at the Big Dumb Fun Show in the Studio 4 of the Ice House with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're going to lighten it up a little bit. We've been talking about, it was kind of light with the King of Sting, but then we kind of got heavy with these Jamaican drug gangs, so let's lighten it back up a little bit. You know, I always had a lot of fun being a policeman. You know, it was, we had funny events and funny things that happened, and I want to tell you an interesting, funny, kind of offbeat story about something that we did one time. It was a drug investigation, and I met a guy, an FBI agent, retired FBI agent named Gary Magnuson. When I went to Las Vegas, Aaron, to interview the retired agents, and there's a true crime author, Denny Griffin, and a mob historian from University of Nevada in Las Vegas named Michael Green.
For your documentary,
Documentary Gangland Wire, I met Gary Magnuson and a guy named Emmett Michaels, and they were pretty interesting guys. They both retired out of FBI in Las Vegas, and Gary stayed out there, and so did Emmett. And I'm talking to Gary. He has written a book called Straw Men, the code name for the investigation of the Las Vegas skim during that 1970s to 80s time was Straw Man. He just told about his career, and he had been a FBI agent assigned to the Milwaukee office before he got transferred to Las Vegas. And when he was in Milwaukee, they were first starting their organized crime program, like Bill Owsley had maybe talked about when they first started the organized crime program in the late 60s, early 70s in Kansas City. All over the United States, the FBI in each major city that had a La Cosa Nostra Sicilian organized crime family started an organized crime program, an organized crime unit. Gary got transferred into that unit, and he did an investigation, and one of his first ones that I read about in his book, he talked about a guy that he had turned and got to testify against some mob people, and the guy's name was Jacob Schlechter. And he gave a description of 6'6" and 250 pounds and a guy with a real leg-breaker mentality. Now, he wasn't Italian, of course. He obviously was German, or German background, German heritage, German name. But he was doing arsons and leg breaking and collection work for a kind of a minor mob character in Milwaukee. It started coming to me that we had done a narcotics investigation and surveillance with the DEA. And I checked with a DEA agent and he said, yeah, he said, I'm pretty sure that's the same guy.
Here in Kansas City,
that we ran into in this narcotics investigation. This was after he went in the witness protection program, I noticed. I think he went in the witness protection program in about 1974 and 1977 or something. He's here in Kansas City, and he does he's selling marijuana is what he was doing at the time, and acting like he was a mob guy.
Jacob Schlechter.
Jacob Schlechter was his name. Although when he was in Kansas City, he was using the name Joe Sharpino. Nice Italian name. Pretended like he was Italian. Pretended like he was connected to the mob because he knew mob things and he knew how that operated. And he got close to some people who actually were Italian and they had a body shop on Independence Avenue, but they weren't really mob people. They had some kind of shirt tail relatives that were connected to the mob, but the guy that owned the body shop wasn't really a mob guy that we'd ever heard of before. This Joe Sharpino, Jacob Slechter, a.k.a. Joseph Sharpino, had purchased a tow truck, and he was an independent operator, but he was hanging out and doing business with this body shop, and that kind of used that as his headquarters. That's how these tow truck guys do. Maybe the body shop doesn't really want to buy their own tow truck, but they'll associate with a tow truck driver who owns his own truck.
And, yeah, who's like an independent contractor.
And he'll go out and maybe hit a wreck and tow it to that guy's lot, and then they may end up getting the job to repair the car and get the insurance job to repair the car.
But he was in the witness protection program at the time.
He was in the witness protection program.
Even though
at the
you're
time.
In the program, you still have to keep like a regular job.
Well, they don't pay you. They give you relocation money, and they set you up and a new identity and get you started. But then after that,
don't give you a salary.
You don't get a salary. You better hope you have either squirreled away some money that the government didn't know about and didn't want back or didn't want to attach or didn't want to seize because it was ill-gotten gains, or you better get you a job.
Or you better have a tow truck.
You better have a tow truck, buy a tow truck and get you a job. And you know, there's one of the more famous guys, Sammy the Bull Gravano. He is the guy that sunk the Dapper Don, John Gotti, in New York City. You know, the government couldn't get John Gotti for years and years and years. Rudy Giuliani, that was going to be his crowning glory. That was going to be his case to end all cases, and he couldn't get the Dapper Don. But a few years later, this Sammy the Bull Gravano, who was the underboss for John Gotti, he ended up testifying against him. They had let that guy go on about 25 murders that they could prove on him. No, they couldn't prove on him that he admitted to about 25 murders that they gave him a walk on in order to testify against John Gotti. And he ends up going to witness protection program. He's down in Arizona somewhere. And the next thing we hear of him, he's indicted on a big time cocaine, marijuana, drugs conspiracy, and he's back in jail now under his, I don't know if he put him back in jail under his old name or his
new name.
I'm not sure about that, but he is definitely back in jail today. I suppose he's in the witness protection jail out there in San Diego, more than likely. You know, they've got a special jail out there in San Diego.
For witness protection people. Everyone knows each other because they're all in
for the same reason, yeah.
Who'd you rat on?
Exactly.
Everyone's going around with their stitches.
Yeah. Snitches get stitches is a popular saying in Kansas City.
Now, but this guy, Jacob Slechter, so he turned state evidence in Milwaukee.
Yes, he
against
did.
Against who there?
I do.
Milwaukee?
I'm going to tell that whole story. Let me tell you the story of us investigating Joe Sharpino. And then we'll go back and we'll find out exactly who Jacob Slechter was. DEA comes to us, and they've got a source that tells us about this guy, Joe Sharpino, who purports to be a mafia guy. And so they come to the intelligence unit to find out, you know, what they can about him. We should have something on him, shouldn't we? Kansas City's not that big. And we check all of our sources, all of our records. We check with the FBI and the organized crime squad there, and they check around, and nobody can find any record. You can't find any kind of record other than a traffic ticket on this guy at all. No criminal record whatsoever.
And this is like 77, so you're looking through like Tickler files.
No, we had computers then. Computers. You know, we had NCIC. We didn't have his fingerprints, but we had his name and full name and a date of birth and a driver's license number. You know, somebody had been in, you know, was an adult, was 40 some years old, around 50 years old, and purports to be this criminal who's driving a tow truck, he's got to have a record by that time. He's got to have some kind of record besides one traffic ticket.
And we don't find anything.
It's kind of suspicious. We're wondering if he's, you know, we didn't think about him being in a witness protection program. We only thought, well, maybe he's taking on a false identity because we figure out who he really is, and he's some criminal from somewhere else, which that happens too. I've ran across that.
And people can have a fake ID.
They can have a whole false identification. They can go to a, you know, go get a kid's. Back then, especially, it was pretty easy. Before 9/11, it was a lot easier, and you could go get a birth certificate of a child that died about the time that you were born. And for me, it had been 1945. Find a kid that was born in 45, died in 46, get their birth certificate and then go and create then a whole false identification. Driver's license, the whole nine yards. And if you really know what you're doing, you used to be able to do that easy. It's really hard to do now, I understand. We couldn't find any criminal record on the guy. And DEA, through this informant, were able to make a few small controlled buys, you know, maybe, you know, like 2 or 3 ounces, you know, 6 ounces, not even a whole pound of marijuana. But he was intimating that he could get a lot of marijuana and can make bigger sales. Of course, our guy, the informant, was not the kind of guy that should have had enough money to make a big buy. You know, you just, you got to be slick. You got to be cool with these things. You don't have a guy that's never bought over a couple, 3 ounces of marijuana at a time in his life and doesn't have anything to speak of, an old crap car and can barely make it from one meal to the next without big barn and stealing money, doesn't have a job.
You're going to be able to buy like a kilo.
All of a sudden, he's got $10,000 to buy, you know, a kilo or two. I don't know what the price of marijuana is, but, you know, all of a sudden he's got $5,000 or $10,000 to buy marijuana and he's going to resell it. And, you know, it just doesn't happen. So you just keep making little buys and you can kind of, as DEA, with the DEA agent that we worked with said, we'll make him into a dope dealer. Because under their guidelines, they had to either make this guy into a big time dope dealer. They had to just walk away and make some state cases.
So the DEA is kind of building a case, if you will.
And they want to make him into a big time dope dealer is what they're trying to do.
On Joseph Sharpino.
Right.
And they're working this case, and they've got an informant who's doing buys, or a controlled buys, right, you call it, which means it's an agent.
He's an informant who makes controlled buys, although he's acting as an agent. You got two different terminologies there. I mean, two different definitions for the same word, agent. He's acting as an agent for the agents, shall we say. And he starts laying the groundwork to introduce a female DEA agent in, saying that she's got a lot of customers in the suburbs, and he knows her from some other dealings. And this Joe Sharpino, he's kind of going for it. So it looks like, you know, we think we've got a mob guy or a mob connected guy that's going to be a big time marijuana dealer. So we all get greedy and the DEA gets real greedy. They want to make this big splash with a real deal mob guy selling marijuana. And they rented us an apartment just down the street from this body shop. And I remember sit up there all day and take pictures and watch to see who comes and goes. We'd have a chase car out. And the informant's been reporting to his agent that he's working for that this guy's talking about going out and beating people up for other people in the mob and collecting money. But we can't see any evidence of any of this. Mm-hmm. But he keeps telling him all these details and dropping these names, and we're still not seeing any evidence. Now, there were some relatives and shirt-tail relatives of this guy that owned the body shop who might have been kind of peripherally connected to the mob, but not really. I mean, they were, you know, they might have had some dirty business going on. But if they did, it was below the radar. Yeah, so
it wasn't anything you were really following anyway.
Right. And so, you know, Tuffy DeLuna wasn't going in there. Or one of the Savellas wasn't going in there. Or even Charlie Mortina or anybody who was a real deal mob person was going in there. Or even a real deal mob associate.
People that you were actually
that we actually knew, we had seen and knew a lot about them, had informants that would tell us about them, that kind of thing. So
when you're surveilling the guy, he's kind of, as his tow truck operation is based out of this guy's car lot or this guy's body shop, and you have another vehicle that's a chase vehicle, as you said, when you would see him leave, you guys would follow him.
They'd kind of follow him around, see where he went, and he wasn't going anywhere.
Picking up actual wrecks and towing them.
Well, I remember one time he said he went to somebody's house to break their legs, quote unquote, break their legs. And we saw him leave, and we had a chase car follow him, and he didn't seem to do anything like that. If he did it, we don't know about it. So we're all getting pretty suspicious of this guy. And I had an informant who had his own tow truck and body shop, and he did some car repossessions, and he also sold used cars and sold them, and he'd take payments on them. So I got my guy to go in and just strike up conversations and say, hey, you got a tow truck, you know, how about doing some car repo job for me? And the guy, this Joe Sharpino, he was suspicious. So he turned down my guy's job. My guy tried to get him to go into business with him to see what, because this guy, we trusted my guy. I knew my guy. And the DEA
did a really good job, and he was doing stuff.
They didn't really have a big track record with this kid that was working for him. Now this kid, and he was naive, and he was young, and
the DEA agent,
the DEA's informant, trying to
build a big buzz.
Yeah, and we should have been suspicious. Now where it gets kind of funny is the informant.
So how long were you guys on this? Were you're in an apartment? You're watching.
God, I bet we're there a month, man. I bet we're there a month. We spent a lot of time on it. I mean, the DEA was greedy. They wanted this mob dope dealer because if they got a mob dope dealer, they could rub it in the face of the FBI. See, it's this kind of interagency rivalry. And
so after a couple of weeks,
we're doing this. I remember one time I was up in this old crappy apartment, and it was a crap apartment. And actually, I tell you where it was. You know it was just down the block. You know those apartments that burnt and killed the firemen here not too long ago?
Up on like Benton Boulevard.
At Independence and Prospect. Well, it was a building about like that one, only just a block east of there with this building I was in. And it was crappy, and it had cockroaches all over the place. And almost, what did we do? We got it furnished, but there was only, you know, a table and chairs in the kitchen area, and I think one sofa and one chair, and that was it, and a wood floor. So I'm up there. I got this camera all set up, and I hear a knock at the door. It's like, and he knocks again. And then he says, maintenance. I said, just a minute. So I run around, and I put the camera up. I hide it in the closet and then go open the door, and here I am, kind of this clean cut, halfway clean cut looking peckerwood in this apartment with like one chair,
bare amount of furniture,
one sofa, one chair, no TV, no anything else, you know, a table and chairs, no radio, no nothing else, no pictures on the wall. And he walks in,
no
he said, no clothes. Well, he didn't get that far.
He said, look in the closet here. Wait.
That's where the camera was.
Yeah.
He said, I just need to come in and spray for bugs or for roaches. And I said, well, hey, man, I'm kind of busy right now. Could you come back later? He said, okay. You know, he never came back. I think he was just checking us out. They'd probably gotten wondering, who were these people up there?
You didn't hear him knocking on the other hall.
No.
The doors down the
I didn't,
hall.
I
just
didn't.
Yours.
No, I didn't.
Like, he would hear that, wouldn't
he? He knew I was the police after he went in and took a look.
So
the informant then reports that our man Joe Sharpino, or Jacob Schlechter, had a heart attack, and he was in St. Luke's, and he had heart surgery, and he comes out of heart surgery, so that like puts everything on hold. We can't introduce him to the female DEA agent. We can't do anything, and that was going to be the make or break time. If she was supposed to get introduced into him, and then she was either going to make him, or they'd have to just let it go, because she was going to say, you know, I want to buy like 20 pounds of weed.
Yeah. She was a DEA agent. She was going to do another buy.
She was going to do
a large amount.
She was going to do a big buy. And
out of the hospital?
Well, yeah, really. Well, it got funny in the hospital. That's where it got funny. It was already a little bit funny, and we were suspicious. And the informant comes to his DEA control, and he said, Sharpino wants to get married while he's in the hospital because he's worried he might die, and he has his girlfriend, and they want to go ahead and get married. The agent says, well, okay, that's fine. He said, but he wants me to marry him. Should I do that? He said, what do you mean he wants you to marry him? And he said, well, I have a universal life minister license that I got online, or not online back then. I got through the mail. I was a mail order preacher. And I guess in Jackson County, Missouri, you can go get a license. As long as you qualify for the license, then you can get somebody who has a universal life,
as long as they're
church
minister's
license, then he can sign off on that license as the licensed minister. You need the licensed minister and you need the civil license in order to make it a legal marriage.
This is the guy.
This is the informant.
Snitch.
Yeah, we were dying. We were saying, okay, we're gonna wire up the snitch to get the ceremony on tape or what? We didn't. And so he goes in and he marries a guy in the hospital. He comes out of the hospital, and then we're ready. We get him introduced to the lady DEA agent. They meet at Denny's, and we're all sitting around. Well, first time they're going to meet somewhere out in Johnson County, and then this guy doesn't show up. Sharpino doesn't show up. So then you got to go back, and then the informant has to come back around and say, well, what happened? And he said, oh, you know, I got busy. I had to do something else.
I couldn't make a sale for 50 pounds?
Well, that's that's the deal, isn't it? They agree to meet again. She's had some telephone contact with him, and she calls him again and says, well, I talked to our mutual friend here, and he said that you got distracted by a job, and I understand that, but she said, I still want to meet with him. So now they're going to meet in Denny's at 16th and Broadway, and we surround the place, and we've got a couple of agents inside, and she's sitting there waiting, and he finally shows up. He's late, of course, about 30 minutes late. Here's the thing that policemen will say, you know, if you're doing working under undercover narcotics and you're going to meet your dealer that you want to make your buy from, don't show up on time. Show up on what we call narcotics time. Be at least 20 or 30 minutes late, because they never do anything on time. Mm-hmm. And if you miss them, if the guy goes on, you just turn back around, you know, because it's understandable. Policemen show up on time. Policemen show up 15 minutes early. Narcotics dealers never show up on time. This guy's 20, 30 minutes late. Finally gets there, and he just, you know, he's hitting on her, and he's humming and hawing around, and he's acting, he's pretending like he's going to get some dope for her, but he never really gives her enough conversation
about getting it.
Yeah, he didn't have anything. They were ready to blow it off by then, but they had about four or five small buys from the informant. So they just decided they would go ahead and take him down on those four or five buys. They wanted to get something out of it. They spent all this time in it. Their boss was saying, you know, that we're done. This is over.
Either bring me back the case for the 50 pounds and a major buy,
right,
or bust him for all these small
just,
buys.
Get him a small bust of some kind. At least let's get him in and see who he is for sure. Get his fingerprints and all that.
So they bust him right there at the Denny's?
No. Just let him go then. We know where he is. He's over at the body shop every day. He did act like he could supply some weed, but it just... time that something had to happen. Well, what another thing that had to happen is they had to identify him.
Yeah, they still really only had. Someone had pulled him over, so they had a driver's license with the...
Well, we got the driver's license and all, we had done all that, but what we need is fingerprints. I remember going to our fingerprint ID person. Remember, our friend David Starbuck used to work for this guy. He might have been working there at that time. They were experts at fingerprint ID on identifying people. And so I went to this guy's name was Dean. I can't remember his last name. And I told him the situation. I said, you got any ideas? I said, you know, are there any other records we can check? And he said, I'll call back to my friend at the National Crime Information Center, NCIC. They keep all the national records via fingerprints, and to have them do some kind of a hand search for this, what we've decided must be some kind of alias, and see if they can find anything. And about two or three days later, Dean gets hold of me, and Dean pointed out, well, when Dean got hold of me, he pointed out, and you know, it went right over my head at the time. I probably didn't even look down at the address. His driver's license, which he had been issued, turns out real recently, was 811 grand. Kansas City, Missouri. Well, 811 grand was a federal courthouse.
this is the witness relocation and witness protection program.
They issued him his new driver's license under the name Joe Sharpino.
Like he got to pick his name or something. So he's giving an Italian name.
Yeah, I think so. But they issued it and used the address of 811 grand. And I don't know, it just went over all of our heads. You didn't even, you know, didn't really put that together. And in the federal courthouse at the time at 811 grand, that was the offices of the U.S. Marshal's Office, which runs the Witness Protection Program, and the FBI and the ATF. Only DEA is the only law enforcement, federal law enforcement, didn't have offices at 811 grand.
When all this time you were tailing him, you never, well, if this is his license and this is his address, let's maybe drive by and see.
Well,
man, he's got a nice place
here. Well, we knew where he lived.
He had a different physical address.
So we didn't even go back and look at the driver's license. Well,
did you guys get fingerprints off him from something at Denny's?
No, we didn't. I guess we could have. We didn't really think about that at the time. This all kind of came together. My friend Dean gets a call back from the FBI, and he won't say directly, but he said, you know, he said, you better check with the U.S. Marshal before you do anything else on this guy. And we knew right then he was in the witness protection program. Then it all made sense. And Dean pointed out he had this address, 811 Grand.
Call over at the U.S. Marshal's
office. Well, see, they won't tell just anybody. I think they will tell even the DEA. They wouldn't tell the DEA, so they went to the U.S. Attorney's office, I believe. I remember right. And then U.S. Attorney's office then consulted with the Marshal's office, and then they came back to the DEA and sat down and listened to the case they had, which was really a nothing case. This guy was not really a dope dealer, and he wasn't really a leg breaker for the mafia. He wasn't any kind of mafioso in Kansas City.
But they wouldn't say who he was. They're just like, well, tell us what you got.
Yeah, I don't think they ever gave us his name or where he was from. If they told the DEA agent that, he didn't tell me. Now, they may have told him that, and he was told not to tell me because I was local police. But I never knew what his name was until I met Gary Magnuson. And so
How many years later is this?
Oh, it's like 20 years later.
When you were in Vegas for...
When I was in Vegas to interview.
Through the documentary and
I was long retired and... Been to law school and made three. That was my third film I made. I made a lot of water under the bridge between the first event and then meeting Gary Magnuson. And so I got a hold of Gary, and I read his book after I'd met him. And I got a hold of him. I said, tell me about this deal. And he said, he was a real deal kind of mob associate leg breaker in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee. And he ended up testifying against some people for us, and he went in the witness protection program, and yeah, he did go to Kansas City. And so I described what we had. He said, yeah, that's got to be the same guy.
Now, wait, so at what point did you realize it was Jacob Schlechter? It wasn't until all these years later?
I didn't know it until years later.
When you talked with Gary Magnuson?
Right. That's when I learned was, 25 years later that was his real name, and that was his history.
In the Roachville department.
I just knew that, In the book, he described Jacob Schlechter as 6'6", 250 pounds, with this one bad eye and a real kind of a leg breaker mean
mentality.
And that's what this guy was, the exact description of this guy. I knew it had to be the same guy. It was in Gary's book. I didn't really talk to Gary about exactly what he did, but I went back and checked his book again. Actually, to make this podcast, I went back and checked his book again.
What was the name of the book again?
What this guy did. Straw Man.
Straw Man.
Straw Man.
Which was the name of the investigation against the mob.
Yeah, the code name for the whole investigation. Straw Man 1 and Straw Man 2, actually, for the Stardust and the Tropicanas.
So after you guys meet with the U.S. Marshal's office or somebody with DEA or whatever, they say, hey, we got this guy. He goes by Joseph Sharpino.
Yeah, right.
All the other guys are like, have their poker face on. Yeah. Oh, man, what's Joseph doing now? Joseph, come on. We got your address here on your driver's license, and they just figured this out.
Yeah, really. We felt a little bit dumb after it was pointed out to us his address on his driver's license was 811 Grand.
Did you continue to rent the apartment and surveil him?
No,
at that
it was
point?
Done. It was
the
a
DEA
done deal.
Said, hey, we're pulling this lease.
We pulled the plug on this thing. Yes. It was a month by month rental, so we only had 1 month into it.
1 month into it.
Yes.
And then, so then what happened to Joseph Sharpino?
You know, he just disappeared. He just disappeared.
He just disappeared.
We don't know what happened to him.
So you were like surveilling it. You stopped surveilling him, or you just
We just dropped him.
Stopped leaving.
There was not. I don't know what happened to him.
But you guys figured out that he was in the witness relocation program of the conversation with the Marshals. Never came forward and said this guy.
No, they would not.
They couldn't actually say that.
No, nobody would. U.S. attorney told.
They're like, well, no, you can't charge him on this.
Told the
just leave the guy alone.
DEA. That no, we're not going to charge him on this. And yes, he is in the witness protection program. And then he just disappeared after that. I figured they relocated him.
Again.
Yeah.
They took his tow truck and he went to Arizona.
Yeah, I don't know. He probably drove his tow truck to Little Rock and probably still towing trucks or towing cars down there today and acting like he's a mob leg breaker. And, another thing about Gary's book, he said, when he brought the guy in, he was a pretty nice guy. He just affected this kind of persona as being a leg breaker, but he broke like a cheap shotgun. He broke down rapidly rather than go to jail whenever they popped him on this deal.
Up in Milwaukee.
Yeah. We're up about 30 minutes. Why don't we just wind this on down and we'll tell in the next episode, we'll tell what he did in Milwaukee in order to get enough information to testify against mob people and put them in jail and cause him to go into witness protection program.
Before he became a tow truck driver in Kansas City.
Before. I don't know what he did. And, you know, it doesn't say in Gary's book, and I never asked him what he did in Milwaukee.
Now, if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a review, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and download Kansas City Mob Tours, the app that allows you to take a tour in your own car of notorious mob locations in Kansas City.
And one other thing, go to my website, ganglandwire.com, and you'll see a little pop-up sign-in button. And if you've already signed in, you don't need to do this again. But if you're a new subscriber, a new person to the website, and you've never signed in, sign in on that, and I will send you a link to a protected page that will have one chapter of my upcoming true crime book. And this is an interesting, different sort of a true crime book. I'll tell you a little bit about it. You know, Kindle books, they're really doing a lot of promotion and doing a lot of things to allow people to write books and put them up on Kindle and make it easy. And you can sell them for, you know, you don't sell them for very much money, sometimes 99 cents. Sometimes they're free for a while, and then they'll go to like $2.99 or $3.99, nothing over $3.99, I don't think, for most of them. And I'm going to keep the price on this down because I want to sell a lot of copies.
Do you have a title for it yet?
Well, you know, I don't. I got a working title of Gangland Wire. I can't decide if I want to stick with that or not. You know, I'm using Gangland Wire on everything else, and it is kind of the Gangland Wire. And
give it a title and like a subtitle, like you have this with the podcast called Gangland Wire Crime Story.
Right, exactly. To differentiate, the other one is just Gangland Wire. The documentary is just Gangland Wire. This is Gangland Wire Crime Stories. I never thought about it like that, so I could have Gangland Wire.
Something about within the context of the book, which is really, again, the
right. It's going to be
how they did it from the mouths of the men that did it.
Exactly. And I got all those wiretaps. I got all the audio from all the hidden microphones in the wiretaps during the investigation into the Stardust and Tropicana casinos by the mob guys in Las Vegas and Kansas City and Milwaukee and Chicago and Cleveland. See, we had Kansas City had a mole out there in the Tropicana named Joe Augusto, and Joe Augusto was calling our underboss, Tuffy DeLuna, sometimes two or three times a day. And they were discussing all the events that were going on in Las Vegas. Particularly, they did a lot of discussion of a guy named Lefty Rosenthal, who was the Ace Rothstein character played by Robert De Niro in the movie Casino. And they talked about what he was into, and he was causing a lot of trouble. For example, if you remember in the movie, he was called in front of the gaming commission, and he got really mad because they wouldn't hear any of his evidence. I just finished dealing with this.
Some of the calls that were
particular
related
chapter.
From,
what?
Some of the, you were dealing with this in terms of like not listening to conversations with Lefty, but rather with
Joe Augusto telling talking. About the background, what was really going on out there. And to listen to these mob guys talk about the makeup of the gaming commission. If you remember, Dick Smothers played the part of the chairman of the gaming commission. He had a confrontation with Ace Rothstein. Well, that really happened. Harry Reid, who is now Senator Harry Reid, was the chairman of the gaming commission. And he had a confrontation with Lefty Rosenthal, and just like in the movie, only it was a little bit different than what they said in the movie, but it was a lot like it too. I think the author probably had reviewed a lot of these wiretaps, or at least had interviewed the U.S. attorneys, and I know they interviewed Bill Owsley, who was the case agent on this, so they knew these kinds of details. Well, I've got the actual voices of Joe Augusto reporting to Tuffy DeLuna exactly what happened in that confrontation. They had a special code name for Harry Reid. It was Clean Face. So we got all kinds of cool little things like that in it, and since it's a Kindle book, they've got this new way to make books, and it's called a Kindle textbook. Although this isn't a textbook particularly, I suppose it could be used as a textbook in an organized crime class. the textbook, we can hook links to the Kindle book. So you just tap on your screen, or if you're looking at it on your computer, your mouse, I click on the link and I can link, just like inside of a website, you know how you get in a website, you have highlighted text and there's a hypertext link to that, and you link to that and you go somewhere else. So you can link from the book to a YouTube site, which I'm setting up, which will have the actual audio accompanied by rolling text, that so you can listen to it and read at the same time, and you can hear Joe Augusto and Nick Savella and Tuffy DeLuna and Oscar Goodman and Angelo La Pietra out of Chicago and people like that, Joseph Lombardo.
All discussing the various aspects of the scheme that you cover in the book.
Exactly, exactly. So I'll explain what they say, because you can't really, if you're the uninitiated, you can't really understand what they say if you don't have the background. So I explain what they say in the context around it, and then you actually get to hear them say it and read it in the book.
You can't just go to like YouTube and find this audio, because it's behind it. It's not. It's connected to the actual book that you're writing.
It's protected. You can't just go and find it. I've got several of those clips up.
Now, you put one up that you ask people to just kind of read and review and listen to and give you some feedback on, which is
right.
Out there
now. And I got a lot of positive feedback about it. There's a lot of interest in this.
If you go to ganglandwire.com, I think it's one of the blog entries.
It is. I can't remember the name of the blog entry. It's about the third blog entry. And just go to my blog and start scrolling down. You'll find it. And while you're there, you'll see the podcast. And while you're there, subscribe to the website, because I want to build a little bigger email list.
Tell your friends if you enjoy the podcast. And we should probably do a public service announcement.
We should. You know, if you have a friend, relative, an employee, an employer, or a coworker who has a problem with drugs or alcohol or any other compulsive behavior, gambling, that's a big one. Make first call your first call. Call 816-361-5900. They can do assessments of somebody and decide if they really have a problem with alcohol or drugs or not. They have a special program called How to Cope, and it's just for people who are friends or relatives and loved ones of addicts to help them deal with the person and deal with the problem. And if you're in Cleveland, this is my friend Sam Renzo from Cleveland. Call the Cleveland National Council at 216-226-2844. That's the Cleveland National Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence. Or if you're in Chicago, just go. They've got a really good website with a lot of resources in Chicago. Go to www.chicagorecovery.org.
And if you're in Kansas City, go to firstcallkc.org or call that number, 816-361-5900. They've got a 24/7 crisis hotline.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.